small constellation, the crown. Ophiuchus has seized him with both hands and is pulling him away from that. So your symbolism there is not something they got out of paganism, I can assure you. The brightest star in the constellation Ophiuchus is in his head. And in Arabic, it's named Ras al-Haggus, the head of him who holds. And he holds the serpent, holds him back from victory. Other stars in Ophiuchus are named Triophus, meaning treading underfoot, and Saith, bruised, Megaros, meaning contending, and Carnibus, the wounding. This is a battle to the death. The constellation Serpens, the serpent that he's grasping, is, as I say, one of these ancient ones shown on these old zodiacs. Again, in the same general portion of the sky, is the constellation Hercules. This was so named, of course, by the Greeks. This is shown as a mighty man bending on his right knee, his right heel lifted up again as if wounded. Now, his left foot is directly over the head of the constellation Draco, the dragon. In his right hand, he's grasping an upraised club ready to strike with it. And in his left hand, he is strangling a triple-headed monster. So, it's battle, all right. In the zodiac at the temple at Dendera in Egypt, it shows him as a human figure with this upraised club. His name in Egyptian is Bau, meaning he who is coming. They knew he wasn't here yet. The brightest star, which is in his head, is Ras al-Gethi, the head of him who bruises. Now, as I say, the Greeks perverted everything they touched. It's unfortunate. All we know about some of these ancient peoples is what Greek travelers wrote about them after they came back. But it seemed to be an essential part of the Greek character or the Greek civilization that you must always garble things up badly. You find, of course, much Greek writing about the Egyptians, and you cannot find one Egyptian pharaoh, including the one who was on the throne when this Greek writer was traveling in Egypt. You cannot find the name of one Egyptian pharaoh that you can recognize at all. Now, if he tells what he did, that in his day he had a war with such and such a country, you can find out from the Egyptian histories what pharaoh it was. But the names bear no resemblance at all. And they did, in their paganism, garble things up pretty badly. As I say, changing this to their mythical hero, Hercules. Now, the wiser Greeks knew the utter perversion of their paganism. Aristotle, for example, in his book Metaphysics, says about the Greek mythology that religion and philosophy had been lost. He said much had been added after the mythical style, and some little had come down and may have been preserved to our times as the remains of ancient wisdom. Polybius says that in his day, religion, such as it was recognized as a necessary means to political ends. Neander says that their religion was the fragments of a tradition which transmitted the knowledge of divine things possessed in the earliest times. But he recognized they had only fragments of it by his own time. Well, here you have these figures trampling on the serpent, the scorpion, the dragon. All right. Take Psalm 91, verse 13. Thou shalt tread upon the lion and the adder, the young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample underfoot. Now the next sign in order was Sagittarius, the archer. This was always shown as a centaur, a mythical figure with the body of a horse and the trunk, arms, and head of a man. And this centaur, holding an arrow, bow and arrow, the bow drawn, ready to let fire, and his arrow is aimed directly at the heart of Scorpio. Now, why the mythical figure of the centaur, if it's setting out Bible truths? Well, the centaur had two definite natures, a higher and a lower, didn't he? He was part man, he was part animal. It was to suggest that the creature that this was representative of also had two natures, Jesus Christ, God, and also man. That was very probably the reason for this. Anyway, they all agreed upon the figure. They all agreed upon the name. Hebrew and Aramaic name, Keseth, the archer. Greek, Toxotes, the archer. Latin, Sagittarius, the archer. Now, in Egyptian and in Coptic, they gave him the name Pimaeri, the beauty of the coming forth. And in the ancient Akkadian, the name was Nunki, meaning prince of the earth. Well, here is this figure with his higher and his lower nature, ready to fire an arrow into the heart of the scorpion. Let's try Psalm 64, verses 7 to 9. God shall shoot at them with an arrow. Suddenly shall they be wounded. So shall they make their own tongue to fall upon themselves. All that see them shall flee away, and all men shall fear, and shall declare the work of God, for they shall wisely consider of his doings. Now, Jesus Christ was the one who destroyed the power of Satan, the one who had the double nature of God and man, was the one who was victorious. And while, of course, he will ultimately use the entire power of God the Father to shoot these arrows, don't forget that it was the one with the dual nature who accomplished the triumph. Close to Sagittarius is the constellation Draco, the dragon, showing with his head right beneath the foot of Hercules. Now, from the Orient, that is China and Japan, we've gotten the idea of the dragon as a sort of superheated alligator. But among the peoples of Western Asia and the Mediterranean, it was a serpent, not the Chinese or Japanese-style dragon. In the zodiac of Dendera, this constellation Draco is shown as a serpent beneath the front hooves of Sagittarius, this centaur. His front hooves are just about to come down on and smash this serpent. And the Egyptian name, Herfent, the serpent accursed, was given to him. The brightest star in the head of Draco, Thuban, the subtle. 47 centuries ago, that was the pole star. The next brightest star in the head is Rastaban, head of the subtle one. Arabic, it's called Al-Wa'id, who is to be destroyed. And the third brightest star in the constellation is named Ethanin, the long serpent. The next, number five in the list, Capricornus, the goat, is a strange one indeed, because in all the ancient zodiacs, it's a compound animal, something like the centaur. From the waist forward, it has the forequarters and head of a goat, and the rear half of it is a fish's body and tail. You didn't raise any of those when you were on the farm, did you? Now, it's always showing with the goat just collapsing in death. The front legs are buckled under it. The head is drooping. It's just collapsing in the moment of death. But the rear half, this fish's tail, is squirming with vigorous life. Now, what's all this about? Well, you don't get any solution out of paganism. But go back to the Bible and see what happened with regard to a goat. You remember I've told you about the Day of Atonement. Well, some of you may not have heard it. The symbolism of the animal sacrifices in the Bible was very clearly this. At any time during the year, any Israelite who realized he had committed a sin could go to the temple and offer the animal sacrifice. Not that the Bible said there was any particular merit in cutting the throat of a sheep or a goat, but that you were acting out this statement. I recognize that the penalty of my sin is death, and it has to be my own death unless someone dies in my place. I am offering the death of this animal not as the real sacrifice, but as a symbol that the time is coming when the Redeemer is going to die in my place. That was the meaning of the animal sacrifices. Now, having done this, he went away cleansed of his sin. He'd left his sin behind him at the temple. It still had to be accounted for, even though not by him. So, all during the year, all the sins of all the people were accumulating at the temple until you came to the Day of Atonement. Now, as is set out in some detail in the book of Hebrews, the high priest was symbolic of Jesus Christ. The high priest was dressed normally in very gorgeous robes, the finest of linen, beautifully embroidered in colors and in gold thread. He had on his head not a mitre. That's some more of the perversions in your King James Version. You've seen a Catholic bishop's mitre, the tall cap cut on top so it looks like the gaping jaws of a fish's head. It was intended to. They got it from the priests of Dagon in Babylon. Dagon was the fish god, D-A-G-O-N, spelled in your Bible, and you probably call it Dagon, but that's what it is. What he wore was a turban, not a mitre, on the front of which was a polished gold plate engraved Holiness unto Yahweh. Then he had on his breast the breastplate, an embroidered pouch of linen, and attached to that another plate of polished gold set with 12 gemstones, each stone being engraved with the name of one of the tribes of Israel. What are you going to do if you want to try to make a person symbolize the majesty of God? It's an impossible thing, but about the best you can do is to give him some very ornate uniform, at least, to set him apart, isn't it? So that's what they did. And the high priest ordinarily wore this uniform, which was symbolic of the full majesty of God. But on the Day of Atonement, there was a very special ceremony. Now, he was only a man. He had his own sins, which barred him from acting out the part of Jesus Christ, until he first offered a sacrifice for his own sins, so that cleansed of those, he was now permitted to go on and act out the part. He offered then a sacrifice to cleanse the temple of the sins of the people which had accumulated throughout the year. Now, as you know, the layout from the tabernacle in the wilderness right down through Solomon's temple and all was three parts. There was an outer court into which the people could come bringing their sacrifices, which they handed over to the priests. There was an inner court containing the altar where the priest burned the sacrifices on the altar, and there was an innermost Holy of Holies into which no one could go, not one of the priests, except the high priest only, and he could enter it only on the one day of the year, the Day of Atonement. Now, in this Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, the chest in which the stone tablet with the Ten Commandments written thereon by the finger of God, and Aaron's rod that budded to show that God had chosen him to be the high priest, and a golden jar full of a sample of the manna. These were contained in this chest. It was about 4 feet long, about 2.5 feet wide, and 18 or 20 inches high. Set down flat on the ground, it would make a seat that one could sit on. And it was called the mercy seat. God said, I will be sitting there in the Holy of Holies. Now, on each end of it, there was a large carved and gilt statue of an angel with outstretched wings. They were so placed that the angel at the left end, his right wing extended out over the Ark of the Covenant to the center point, and the angel at the other end, his extended wing came out to meet this one, so they formed a canopy over the mercy seat. Well, this, of course, represented heaven, where God, in all his majesty, maintains his headquarters. Now, the high priest, having cleansed himself of his own sins and cleansed the temple, two goats were brought to him, chosen on behalf of the entire nation. And by casting lots, one goat was selected to be offered as a sacrifice for the people. The other goat, your King James Version with its customary distortion and mistranslation, says one goat for a scapegoat, and there's nothing like it in the original Hebrew at all. It says one goat for Azazel. Now, Satan is not a name of any person at all. It's a title. It means the opponent, the adversary. Manager is not a name. Even if you're speaking of manager of some particular company, it doesn't tell you who is the manager. And Satan doesn't tell you who is the opponent. The other title used in the Bible, Lucifer, the shining one, again, is not a name, but only a title, and it doesn't tell you who he is. And you've got to look in the book of Enoch to find the answer to that, because the Bible itself does not explain about Azazel, although it does mention him, one goat for Azazel. In the book of Enoch, it tells how the rebel angels coming to earth had decided to intermarry with human women, and that their descendants were giants, and that these angels, rebel angels, were teaching men all kinds of sins. Now, it gives the names of 20 or 30 of the principal ringleaders, and one of these is Azazel. So God sends a committee of four of the great archangels down there to investigate and report back. That's very similar to what you have in God's investigation about Sodom and Gomorrah before destroying them. So they come back and they say, yes, it is every bit as bad as it was reported. So God tells one of them, I forget which one now, Raphael or Uriel, he says, you... to Azazel ascribe all sin. There wouldn't have been any sin committed by men if he had not taught them so. To Azazel ascribe all sin. Now you go down there and tie him up and cast him into a pit out in the desert, and we'll leave him there till I get around to his final judgment. Now note the symbolism of the Day of Atonement. These are goats now, not sheep. One goat is chosen as a sacrifice for the people and one goat for Azazel. Now the high priest takes off these magnificent robes of office, bathes, dresses in plain white linen, symbolic of sinless purity, and comes back to perform the ceremony of the Day of Atonement. Jesus Christ laying aside the full majesty of the Godhead to come in the form of a man, but a man with no sins of his own. Now, the goat on behalf of the people is sacrificed, and the high priest takes some of the blood of the sacrificed goat, and he goes in through the veil into the Holy of Holies and sprinkles a little of this blood of the goat in front of and on the mercy seat, reminding God all these sins that earned the penalty of death have been paid for. Here is the shed blood to show they've been paid for. They're entitled to thy pardon. Then he comes out of the Holy of Holies. He puts on again his majestic robes. You remember in the book of Hebrews, it tells us how Jesus Christ is our real high priest, and he is in the heavens until the time of the restitution of all things when he will come back. So, symbolic of the return of Jesus Christ, not the second time, in the form of a man to be pushed around and murdered, but coming back with all the majesty and power of God. And he takes the remaining goat for Azazel, and this one is not sacrificed. He lays his hands on the head of this goat and confesses over him all the sins of all the people. And then this goat is dragged out of the city to the edge of the desert and given a good sound kick and sent on out into the desert. He's going back to Azazel with the message, "Hear, Azazel, all these sins are yours. For you there's no sacrifice. You answer for these." So, by the goat, the one sacrificed, that goat died, but the people received life by it. And of course, that goat sacrifice in behalf of the people was again symbolic of Jesus Christ by his death paying the death penalty for us. Now get back to our figure of Capricornus, the dying goat, but the other half of him, this fish, squirming with vigorous life. Now you probably know that the cross was not used as a symbol of Christianity for the first 2 centuries A.D. Up until that time, they used the fish. You remember Jesus Christ had told a couple of his disciples, "I will make you fishers of men." And since fish multiply tremendously, forming great schools or shoals of fish, the fish was symbolic of the way Christianity would multiply into great numbers of people of that faith. So, the fish part was living with vigorous life because the goat part died. One of the stars in Capricornus bore the Arabic name Deneb al-Gedi, the sacrifice comes. Incidentally, at the time of the crucifixion of Christ, at that time of year, the sun was in this sign Capricornus and very close to this star, Deneb al-Gedi. So whoever placed the constellation there and knew the significance of it knew also prophetically the time of year when it would be. You remember it was at Passover, so Moses told them what time of year it would be, what day of their month it would be. So all this was known from early times. But now there isn't any part of this that evolved out of paganism. There isn't any part of this that can be shown to illustrate or support paganism. The pagan peoples knew that that's what these constellations were supposed to represent. And they even had names for the stars showing the significance. But they were merely repeating what had been taught centuries before, and without themselves realizing fully the significance of it. Well, let's take one more and then we'll call it enough for this evening. The next one in line is Aquarius, the water bearer. That's the modern Latin name. It was always shown as the figure of a man holding in his right arm a large urn, the mouth tipped somewhat downward, and a great stream of water pouring out of it. And the stream of water pours down into the open mouth of the fish, slightly below his feet. The fish drinks up all this water pouring out of the open mouth of this urn. That fish was called Piscis australis, the southern fish, to distinguish it from the other constellation of Pisces, the two fishes. Now this Aquarius and the fish, that was very ancient. The early Egyptian zodiac show it, and the Arabic peoples had it too. Now, the pouring out of the water, of course, very ancient. Isaiah 44, verses 3 and 4. For I will pour water upon him that is thirsty, and floods upon the dry ground. I will pour my spirit upon thy seed, and my blessing upon thine offspring. And they shall spring up as among the grass, as willows by the watercourses. Psalm 65, verse 9. Thou visitest the earth and waterest it. Thou greatly enrichest it with the river of God, which was full of water. And you remember John 4, verse 14. Jesus Christ said, Whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. So you have the figure of the man, symbolic of Christ, pouring out this water of life, and the fish, remember, the symbol of the Christians, receiving and drinking up all this water of life. So, the one thing that will make sense out of these constellations is the Bible. As against the background of any of the known paganisms, they're meaningless. As compared to the Bible, they make good sense. They illustrate exactly what the Bible is talking about. Starting with the branch, the seed of the woman, he does receive the wound in his heel from Scorpio, but he crushes the head of the serpent. With his hands, he drags it away before it can seize the crown. Everything here meeting the Bible. Incidentally, that wound in the heel, the way these things pass into pagan mythology, appears clearly here. You remember among the ancient Greeks, they had the myth of, who was it now that was killed by a wound in his heel? Achilles. The story among the Greeks was that the mother of Achilles had been warned that he was likely to be killed when he grew up. So she took him to the river Styx, the river that flows between the land of the dead and the living, and she dipped him in the waters of the Styx, which was supposed to give him an armor plate skin that weapons wouldn't pierce. But she had to hold him by something or other. She held him by the heel as she dipped him in, and the heel didn't get dipped. That was the one place that was vulnerable to a wound. And so he was killed by a wound in that heel. Now you find another memory of the same thing showing up in the Germanic myths. You remember the hero Siegfried. Siegfried killed the dragon, and a regular river of blood was pouring out of the cut throat of the dragon. So Siegfried stepped under it to take a shower bath in the blood of the dragon to get this same armor plating effect, which was to make him invulnerable to wounds. But a leaf from a linden tree overhead broke loose and flip-flopped down and landed on his back between his shoulder blades, and that made one spot that the dragon's blood didn't reach. And so the villain Hagen attacked him from behind, hurled a spear into that one vulnerable spot in his back and killed him. Now, the source of those things, you can see where it comes that Christ was to have the vulnerable heel. That is, in the act of crushing the head of the serpent, nevertheless, there he received his own wound.
Pastor Comparé will conclude this subject on the next cassette. This tape was produced by Your Heritage and Pastor Bertrand Comparé. We have much more information in written form and tape recordings, both reel and cassette. We offer this material to assist the personal ministries of those who are called to awaken Yahweh's Israel sheep to the truth of His Word and the necessity for national repentance. Feel free to call upon us for personal consultation. We welcome your suggestions as to how Your Heritage can more effectively spread the gospel of the kingdom. Many people are meeting in their homes using Pastor Comparé's material as the basis for their study. Such groups represent a healthy return to the early assemblies of believers and offers those who finally see the light and come out of the Babylonian church system a place to worship with other believers. We would hope that such meetings would also provide the nucleus of support for our radio broadcast in your area, and we shall be happy to cooperate with you in this regard. As you know, Your Heritage is not associated with any organization. As our congregation, we depend upon your tithes and offerings to pay the expenses of spreading the gospel. We try to merit your support. Please send your letters, your requests for material, and your generous contributions to Your Heritage, P.O. Box 5486, San Diego, California, zip 92105. Goodbye, and may the grace of Jesus Christ be with you all.